Even though I think we may get a few more, I think we'll start maybe with at least beginning. My name is Karen Bloomquist, and this is the third session in the week that I'm doing, and this one on remembering, the theme of remembering. And the topic of remembering, I wasn't even thinking when I said I would do one on this of how relevant this is, especially for those of us that are coming back to Holden. Because in many ways, Holden Village is a place of remembering. And in my case, going back to 1970 when I was first here, and was anybody here before then? Many 80s, 90s, or whatever. And I've been just amazed at how many of the people, you know, when we get to talking around the, you know, the table, etc. Oh yeah, you know so and so, or you know, and so it was evoking a lot of memories that I have, or people that I haven't thought about for a while. And so I think Holden Village is a place that it can easily lapse into a kind of nostalgia. And what we're going to talk about today is not remembering as nostalgia, but remembering that propels us forward into the future. And I think Holden at its best has been that kind of place where, in my case, I came here first when I was probably heading to seminary, etc. And I realized how many things fell into place after I was at Holden, and realizing how strong an influence this place has had on me through the years. And I assume that's many of you, especially those on the work staff, who come back year and year and say, oh yeah, this is a, I mean, it is a special place, but it's also a place of a lot of remembering. So just that with, you know, it's kind of an introduction to the session today. I'm going to be especially leading us into some discussion, and then we'll conclude with a handout that I have here from a very interesting remembering Eucharistic prayer that we used at our church in Berkeley for our Easter vigil, which I thought would be very provocative in terms of a leading discussion. But I want to at least share some things, again, from the book, because I've decided this would be a more succinct way than trying to go on and on about remembering. Remembering is a present activity that draws from the past for the sake of the future. In contrast to a nostalgia that tends to idealize and get stuck in the past. And I think we know plenty of people in our lives, and probably in our lives too, where nostalgia is what people fall into, and you know, something that propels us into the future is not necessarily what we're thinking of. Remembering also, I don't have a particular biblical text here in mind, but throughout the New Testament, we discover that with Jesus, the disciples were continually depicted as forgetting and then remembering what Jesus had said in ways that they didn't quite get before. You know, again and again, the disciples were, in that sense, somewhat dense, especially in Mark's gospel. You know, they've never really got what Jesus was about. And so, for example, at one point he says, do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? And do you not remember? And then he tells them a little bit later, do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many were gathered? And so again and again, he was having to remind people and to bring the reality of who he was into their midst and to propel them into the future. A key aspect, and this is what Adam read in the title, if yesterday seeing is countering the illusions, today remembering is to counter what tends to be the social amnesia, and I'm saying social amnesia, across time and space. In other words, the silencing, the covering over, refusing to see what is truthful or not. especially the wider systemic issues, you know, the kind of political, you know, we talked yesterday about the coal mining communities and seeing all the stuff that's connected. And it isn't just a matter of, oh, I've lost my job in coal. One of my favorite, although somewhat striking commentators is Henry Giroux, who I think teaches in Canada but comments regularly on what's happening here in the U.S. And he says this some years ago: America has become amnesiac, a country in which forms of historical, political, and moral forgetting are not only willfully practiced, but celebrated. And this, I think, particular, the remembering thing becomes especially relevant for those of us living in the Northwest. Are any of you familiar with the book Cascadia? You know, of course, this whole area, including Canada, is often referred to as Cascadia. And one of the contentions in that book and the different essays of it, and I think maybe there's still a copy in the bookstore, at least here there should be, how in Cascadia, individuals become the center of all experience. I recall a few years ago in Bellingham going to an art exhibit of, you know, wonderful creation, environmental things, and people were saying, oh, this is almost religious experience. And the artists were saying, no, no way do I want anything to do with religion. I'm an independent artist, etc. They weren't even wanting to make that connection. Patricia O'Connell Killian, who I think previously taught at PLU, in one of her essays, asks, can and does this place, and she's talking about the span of area in the Northwest, this place in which so many experience themselves to be free from the past, from tradition, and from constrained ties, can this place inspire a vision compelling enough to viably reweave the bonds of humans with each other and with the more than human world for a 21st century global people? Any comments at that point, or does that resonate with?
Could you read that one more time?
Can and does this place, in which so many experience themselves to be freed from the past, from tradition, and from constraining ties, you know, clearly this is behind the phenomena that this is supposedly the area where, you know, people really don't have, or the vast majority don't necessarily have connections with, for example, a church. Can this area inspire a vision compelling enough to viably reweave the bonds of humans with each other and with the more than human world for a 21st century global people?
A 21st century one.
Global people.
Yeah, I don't know when that was written. Oh, sorry. It's somebody else. But I think
probably about 10 years ago.
I think the Northwest, I'm from Olympia, but I think it just the place, the beauty and the spirituality of the salmon returning every year, it kind of inspires it, I think. I think there's a lot of unchurched people there. There's Wiccans, and then we have a procession of the species. And people, but there's a lot of people who are very socially active that are unchurched in Olympia. And we're the left post. We're in supportive of immigrants and outcasts. And in some ways, I think the spirituality comes through in spite of what people want to be independent. That's my take.
Yeah, I also. So, I mean, I've spent all of my adult life living in community and working in social justice areas and environmental areas. So that might be a very skewed perspective, but my perception of the Northwest, at least the urban areas, and is that there's a lot of collaboration, which isn't quite the same as community necessarily, but I mean, there are a ton of people seeking community, living in community, trying to establish intentional communities. The difference between that and, say, a place like Holden, which I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of years trying to discern, is that these communities are proudly secular. The people that get to work on environmental issues, and they talk about, you know, reaching out to faith communities that may also be doing this, etc. But the idea that there is an organized spirituality is what I think sticks in people's throats.
Mm-hmm.
But not that the both seeking out and attempt to establish community, which I think is huge. And when you go into other parts of the country, in the jobs I've had as I traveled around the country, when we tried to talk about building bridges and collaborations in a secular environment, people are always like, oh, but you're in the Northwest, you all collaborate and work together all the time, effectively.
Yeah.
So I think we have sometimes I think we see ourselves in a way that certainly doesn't reflect my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with that, but you've had to be very intentional in that community, seeking out community and collaborating, right?
If by that you mean it has to be created as opposed to being able to fall into an established faith group, yes. I mean, because I could just choose to hang out my own faith group or whatever, in which case, but my perception also is that there aren't always functional communities within church communities.
Yeah. Let me just move on a little bit in terms of this discussion, but I think there's a little pushback, which I think those of us who have or are now living in the Northwest say, well, that's not quite true of the Northwest. And I think that's important. But the danger, and again, we want to focus on why memory is important. When memory is eroded, people are deprived of how remembered tradition can resource them today. A community's memory provides accumulated insights into how things came about and into what we as human beings are up against. The danger is that in becoming a memoryless, traditionless society, we become incapable of empathetic responses to the claims of other living beings, much less of the rest of creation. And here, somebody was raising a question or about mega churches the other day, but I think this could apply to many. The way many Protestants in the U.S. have learned to do church has militated against a strong and nurturing connection to the past. The way in which many Protestants have learned to do church has militated against a strong nurturing connection to the past. And I'm thinking, for example, a lot of churches that now are non-denominational. Now, there may be in ways in which the history of Christian tradition is embodied there, but so many, you know, for example, a lot of people say, oh, I don't necessarily want to be a part of any denomination or any tradition. And again, I'm into being very ecumenical at the same time, but at the same time, how important traditions are for nurturing us for the long haul, whatever that tradition is. Without the necessary formative culture that can provide Americans with a language that enables them to recognize the political, economic, and social causes of their problems, then, according to Henry Giroux, a politics of despair, anger, and dissatisfaction can easily be channeled into a politics of violence, vengeance, and corruption. Feeding far-right movements willing to trade in bigotry and brutality. Unquote.
Pretty relevant, isn't it?
Again, this was written some years ago, you know, maybe within the last 10 years, but certainly before the present, right. And again, not that everybody who is traditionalist falls into this, but again, remembering the tradition, remembering where we've come from is really important. I think especially becomes crucial in this remembering is that too often the losers disappear and drop from memories. You know, the loser in the family who isn't really talked about because they, quote, haven't made it, whatever that makes. Or they're, you know, they're a drunk, or they're a, quote, good for nothing, or whatever, you know, all the societal judgments that get put on them, or that the family puts on them, because they haven't, quote, made something of themselves according to the American dream. Instead, remembering the losers and their history opens up a wider critical social analysis. It opens up greater possibilities for solidarity with those left behind. It erupts from below. It is a remembering that the powerful interests would prefer be overlooked. It leads toward questioning or critiquing of what is for the sake of our and God's future, rather than remaining in bondage to closed systems that are considered unchangeable, fixed. Waiting for God to come and remembering the God who has come together create an open attitude toward life as a gift flowing from the past as well as into the future. That last sentence is actually by a Norwegian theologian. Any responses to some of that? Or comments?
The first part of what you were saying about the traditions and the vocabulary of, I've been thinking about that a lot. Mm-hmm. Recently, I teach Sunday school, but we have smaller and smaller numbers at Sunday school, and I just keep thinking that there's so many things from the Bible that even if you're not religious, it's part of our vocabulary about knowing Adam and Eve and knowing Noah and knowing some of those. There used to be more, I'm blanking out. But the things that you could have analogies and other things, like the Greek gods, who I also don't know who they are. But I'm wondering if there's any communities that have started things like after school ethics education or something like that to help people learn that in a new way. I mean, it just seems it's important to have those vocabularies and to have it, maybe even if the tradition isn't there, the history is there.
Mm-hmm. Response to that?
I think we have to, I think the tradition can be a good and a bad thing. I think if we get stuck in Sunday school, you know, the way to get to people to come to church is through Sunday school, teaching the traditional stories and such. But I don't think that's going to make it in this culture. I think it's going to be, I think it needs to be more focused on building relationships first. And then through those relationship building, to create, and I think building community as well. And then you get to the stories of faith. Mm-hmm. So I think, and that's what I think people are yearning for, is more of the connectedness to spiritual kind of places. Yeah, my son is a pastor in Oregon, and a story that I've shared with many people is, the church that he's at it's dwindling, and he had a young person, I think she was probably 14 or 15. Her mother had been burned by the church, but she was willing to let her daughter come. And the daughter wanted to participate in liturgy, doing very simple things, like doing one of the readings. And so my son Tyler said, I'd love you to participate in the service. Well, after the service, one of the longtime members called Tyler up and said, was she baptized? Was she baptized? And I mean, you think, really? And so Tyler knew that she had not been baptized, that this was his way of saying, we want you to participate, that will come, maybe, you know, and if it doesn't, no big deal. But this one person was able to basically kind of cut her off. And she had people supporting her. So Tyler was kind of like this desert voice. And, you know, he's struggling to move away from that kind of divisive tradition. And, you know, so obviously the girl never came back, and she gave the mom more ammunition as to why the church is bad.
Yeah.
And I know for a lot of churches, that whole invitation to communion sometimes is still based on being baptized.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I go to a service, I listen for that invitation to communion. What are they going to say?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's such a basic thing in terms of keeping people in or out.
Yeah.
So.
Well, your example, Anne, evokes for me a memory I have, a contrasting memory from our church in Geneva, which was, you know, people from all over the world and lots of different denominations, even though we were a Lutheran congregation. Three teenagers regularly came to all the stuff that was going on. Their mother was Finnish, their father was from Afghanistan, a Hindu. They were both parents were doctors. And they had intentionally said, we're not going to raise them in either tradition. You know, we're not going to force it down their throats. But they, through relationships, they regularly connected with people. They would regularly come. They would do lots of things in the congregation. And finally, one of them, when he was 19, decided he was going to be baptized. And it was incredible. I mean, first of all, they did receive communion before they were baptized, I think, even though the pastor kind of, you know, didn't make a big deal of it. But when he was baptized, it was just a real tearjerker because the pastor said, you're being baptized into Christ doesn't mean you're denouncing, you know, the Hindu part of who you are. Yeah. In other words, that's part of who you are. And that shaped you, that tradition has also shaped you, even though they were very active in the Lutheran congregation. And he's saying this incredible rendition of Amazing Grace in front of the altar after he was baptized.
Yeah.
You know, it was really incredible because it was a expression of grace that was embracive of people of different traditions. And and yet the baptism centrality was still there, but not as the entrance right to somehow being able to participate in things.
Yeah.
And I think we're more and more, I'm not, so I don't want to water down the centrality of baptism, but I think for many congregations, it's a matter of who is a member or who isn't.
Right.
You know, are they dues paying, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, when I was a pastor here in Washington, you know, somebody came, I want to be married. Well, what is your connection with this congregation? Well, my grandfather helped build this church, et cetera. Now, they lived in Reno at the time. There wasn't, you know, a real strong connection, but she was, that was still her home church. Mm-hmm. And
the fact that she was seeking a church and not a farm.
That's right. I've been married in a church.
Yeah.
And that was, and again, it because of the church as a body of Christ, it meant that I knew a former student who was a pastor in Reno, so she did the premarital counseling of this couple, because they weren't living in the Bellingham area anymore. And I think much more permeable sense of what it means to be church, but drawing on that tradition, that remembering, is...
Can I share one more story that kind of feeds into this? So another pastor that I know has been struggling with how do you do that welcoming to communion, because mm-hmm. he really wanted it to be an open thing. And so he's come up with the line, all who want to learn more about Jesus are welcome welcome to communion. And after this one particular service, a woman came up to him with a hijab on, was obviously Muslim, mm-hmm. and said to him, I felt so welcomed to come to communion. Who would, you know, from her perspective, who wouldn't want to learn more about Jesus? Jesus is a prophet to the Muslims as well. And Eric was just blown away that a simple rephrasing was engage somebody who wasn't Christian.
And suddenly becoming a follower of Jesus became a little bit more acceptable even for a Muslim.
Yep, yeah. So anyway, it was a wonderful kind of take on...
Beautiful way to
Isn't
do it.
Yeah,
yeah,
it is.
We'll be talking a little bit more about the break, you know, because for me, increasingly, what it means to be Christian is moving beyond the us versus them, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, which is what, if we are a follower of Jesus, that's what he was doing again and again. And what does that mean in terms of what it means to be Christian?
I have a cousin in Bellingham, and they were Lutherans years ago, but they now are going to what they consider a mega church, mm-hmm. and so I've gone some Sundays to mm-hmm. see what it was about, mm-hmm. and the numbers of people that attend that church, they have three services, mm-hmm. and it's like stadium seating in an old theater-type building, mm-hmm. and they're all, you know, most of the seats are full, and they have lots of music and the flashy lights and everything. And the music really does draw you in. But I struggle with, because I like the liturgy of the Lutheran church and the tradition and the services, that there's these people that are unchurched for the most part that are coming, and I wonder what their message is. You know, he does a good sermon, and they get some messages about caring for people and God's love and all of that. But I still struggle between that, you know.
Yeah.
And yet they pull so many people in. Mm-hmm. And
I know the place you're talking about.
I have a clarification question. If they're going to this church, what do you mean by they're unchurched?
A lot of them haven't had any type of, you know, maybe they've had some religious background, but I think they're just, you know, being, you know, coming in, and they don't have the liturgy, they don't have the, you know, the traditional things that, like, I grew up with. And so, and it's a real open service. There's no rules. You know, they have music, and they have the message. They did do a baptism, and I was there the day they did that baptism. Huh. And it was pretty impressive. I mean, the people that were there, you know, that participated, it was very emotional, and I mean, I even kind of cried, you know, based on what they were saying and doing, and then watching them being fully immersed in everything. But because there's no set, you know, what do I want to say?
Doctrine?
Pardon me?
Doctrine?
Yeah, that I just wonder how much people are getting, you know, how, and my cousin said that then they've started doing small groups. But if you don't know much about the Bible stories and the Bible, and I mean, I've learned over the years quite a bit, you know, through our church, and I've grown that way. I just wonder how these people, you know, how they're growing individually, you know, in the religion. And my cousins, they, like I said, they're Lutherans, so they have, and they're a lead for some small group, but it just kind of makes me wonder how you know, based on my experience, how these other people that don't have much of a background.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a Quaker. Have any of you ever been to a Quaker meeting?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything you're talking about is alien to me.
Oh, really?
You know, the music, the liturgy.
Yeah.
I mean, I love coming to Holden and listening, and the music especially. But I think it's your denomination and your familiarity. I wonder if that is... I mean, it's legitimate to wonder, mm-hmm. but it's one kind of way of worship.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. our worship sometimes goes on for an hour and a half and there's not a word spoken. Mm-hmm. Other meetings are kind of chatty. But we have other ways of learning about the Bible. I mean, we have study groups and we have different things that people partake of depending on, you know, what their interests are and where they
mm-hmm.
are.
How large is your...
I belong to a couple of different meetings over the years. The one I'm in now is about, we have two different times and people tend to either come at 9:30 mm-hmm. or they come at 11. So the meeting that I go to is about 40 people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think this point is well taken because the remembering, it may be connected with a certain denomination mm-hmm. or a way of doing worship. But remembering is, especially in terms of a God, you know, remembering who God is, and which can come through different forms or different modes. Remembering all that God has said and done, particularly for outsiders, remembering your compassion and love, rememberers call on God to remember and to remember us. And what I'd like to do for the last few minutes is pass around an interesting kind. There's about, I think, 10 or 11 copies of the soldiers. A couple of you may have to read on. And I'm going to invite us to read this together. This was actually something we used at our congregation in Berkeley. For Easter Vigil, which was about a 3-hour service. Do some of you have Easter Vigils in your congregation? Or, yep. You know, which to me, for those of us who, to me, it's an incredible act of remembering and connecting us with God's salvation history from the beginning of time until now. In other words, especially raising up a lot of the Bible stories, for example, the Old Testament that we don't necessarily hear, like Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and some of these, you know, really kind of strange sounding kinds of stories in terms of all the stuff that's going on. I wasn't part of the creation of this, but I did participate in actually an enactment of the story of Esther. But what was interesting in the first part of this is that, as you can see, some of these are meant, this is the prayer before communion, the Eucharistic prayer. But we didn't start necessarily with the beginning of time, but it was all the stories in the Old Testament that are often not raised up, but are forgotten, are not remembered. A story of women who persisted. And it was interesting because what framed this was an event that happened about 2 years ago in the U.S. Senate. Or two months ago, a certain U.S. senator got up and dared to read from Coretta Scott King.
When
I was in opposition to, I think, Jeff Sessions' nomination, mm-hmm. and she was told again and again to sit down, Elizabeth Warren, sit down. And although we didn't mention Elizabeth Warren,
she
persisted. And so our whole Easter Vigil this year was framed around, and still she persisted. And so I think what's interesting in this, as we read through it, it clearly the persistence is also what Jesus was about.
Right.
You know, in terms of the crucifixion and then the resurrection, etc. So what I'd like to do is just to go around the circle and to have each of you kind of read one of the paragraphs, and then the bold part we can say together. So we can start on this end of the row?
I can't see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So start at the top?
Yeah.
Most High God of grace and justice, of Adam, Eve, and Susanna, of Tamar and Ruth, Esther and Sarah, God of Shapar and Po, Josabed and Beahai.
Those last lines are not ones we normally mention, right?
Sure.
We forget about them. And of course, there's a lot of unnamed women in the Bible that we don't remember, too. Okay, next.
We thank you that time and again throughout history, you have empowered your people and strengthened your commitment to creation.
In times of treachery and test, you have become our courage. When alienation, inhospitality, and exploitation threaten to overwhelm us, you become our community. When the rule of law masks injustice, pardons the powerful, underwrites the wealthy, and panders to the privileged, you become our resistance.
She was warned,
they said.
She was given an explanation,
they complained.
Nevertheless, she persisted.
We exclaimed.
Wisdom persisted. Over the force of chaos, wisdom called creation into being at the beginning of time. Wisdom led us through waters of the flood into a new day. Wisdom led us out of slavery into the promised land of milk and honey. Wisdom led us to see in our brother Jesus the one in whom we know God.
Jesus was warned to stay away from tax collectors and sinners.
He was warned
about the stories he told and the community he kept.
He was warned
to cross the road to avoid the unclean, the sick, and the infirm. He was warned about getting too close
with the women, Samaritans, and lepers.
He was warned to defer to those in authority and to trust the powerful.
He was warned.
He was given an explanation.
Nevertheless, he persisted.
He persisted.
By eating with sinners and tax collectors on the Sabbath. He persisted by healing the sick, restoring acceptance to
those who
are unable to see.
He persisted
in inappropriate relationships with all sorts of human beings. He persisted by turning over the temple tables and challenging systems of collusion.
Nevertheless, he persisted.
By trusting, instead of the powerful and the well-connected, the voices of those most at risk, whose lives he valued on the margins of the culture.
He persisted.
Even on that last night, when gathering with his friends and disciples, in taking bread, giving thanks, breaking it, offering it up and saying, "Take and eat, this is my body given for you.
Do this for the remembrance of me."
Again, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it for all to drink, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, shed for you and for all people for the forgiveness of sin.
Do this in remembrance of me."
You can be sure, my friends, that our sibling was born. You can bet that he was offered an explanation.
Nevertheless, he persisted.
And you persist, O Most High God, in sending upon us your Spirit, that we might be gathered up into one body and strengthened with these gifts of bread and wine to be sent out as resistance within the world.
Resistance, together with our siblings, Adam, Eve, and Susanna, with Tamar and Ruth, Esther and Sarah, with Shifra and Hua, Jochebed and Bithia, and with our brother Jesus, who teaches us to pray.
Because it was followed by the Lord's Prayer. Reactions, responses. Actually, every time the Eucharist is celebrated, that key phrase, "Do this in remembrance of me." So it's connected with all that he has been about, but going back to the beginning of time. So those connections are made, and that's why, again, referring to our congregation in Geneva, we had a round kind of altar, and people gathered basically from around the world. Yeah, and so it was like making present, of all those traditions and all those people and the coming together. And the because to me, the important meaning to give to remembering is it is a remembering. It is putting back together again for the sake of the future, not for staying stuck in the past, but for moving us into the future and empowering us. And so there's a sense in which the power of what we receive through the Eucharist and through other means too, but especially for the Eucharist, that empowers us for the future. I wanted to read a paragraph from actually a Roman Catholic nun who was a part of a course I taught at the seminary in Philadelphia. And she's written a book on Eucharist and social justice, but this is what she wrote in the paper she wrote. Eucharist is active. It does what it says. It is about change. The Eucharist changes bread and wine, and it changes us. It has a transformative power, and hence the potential for personal and global transformation. There is an energy in the Eucharist that is liberating, that makes present. As it does, Jesus Christ sets us free. Free from personal and national interest, free from greed and the desire for power. We are set free so that we might no longer live just for ourselves. We are liberated from being satisfied with the status quo, liberated to help set others free, freed to change the world. And I think communities that live into that and out of that, and going back to 2 days ago, how that really means that yes, you can't not do something for the immigrants, for the homeless, for the whatever. In other words, it empowers us, which doesn't mean that others who don't share our faces are not also empowered. But there's a kind of substance, there's a kind of something that propels us forward that is distinctive. And there may be other things that, you know, impel others forward. But I think that becomes important. Any other comments on this or how Eucharist can do that? Were there new perspectives on all of that this provided?
Yeah, I'm taking it home because we have a Bible study. I thought it was clever incorporating Elizabeth Warren's words, but I have friends that would be like waving a red flag in them.
And she wasn't mentioned by.
No, but we do watch the news.
Probably.
So I might take that out, but I think the message comes through with all the other words and the way it was put together. I just think it's a beautiful message. I really like it.
And I like it. It brings out that women are really critical in the history of our faith too. We need to remember that. Mm-hmm.
One of the early books in feminist biblical studies by Elizabeth Fiorenza is called In Memory of Her, in memory of the women in the Bible who weren't given names. Mm-hmm. Back row, somebody said.
As an aside, it made me think about a thing in my work where it's working on some mental health crisis housing and with a group of social service providers, mental health providers, and it was specifically incorporating Native tribes. And in a meeting of all these staff and asking questions about various things, we got to the issue of how do we incorporate Native healing. Mm-hmm. And the person representing the tribal groups had brought her administrative assistant along. And when it got to that question, he said, well, I have to ask my elder. For the elder to respond. was the administrative assistant, to respond to the issue of remember, and tribal spiritual was endowed really with administrative justice and to respond to and clarify the context and the appropriateness for things. So it's not always the person in power that can do the remembering. In that case, it was the elder that had the knowledge and the history.
Yes.
Just going back a little bit to the tradition, and I don't know if it's wrapping into this specifically, Karen, but I think tradition is so important, but the challenge is, I'm hearing a lot of the comments here about how to be inclusive, but value tradition and remembering and all of that. Just one little example, we pull up along to Valley First Lutheran Church, the old Norwegian Lutheran, in Ballard, and the challenge is valuing that tradition, but also being inclusive and opening up to non-Norwegian.
Right.
Do we accept Swedes? Do we accept Danes? non-white, non-Lutheran.
Yeah.
And it's something that we're kind of working through right now. Kind of open to it, but again, we want to value the tradition and kind of where we came from, but also.
When I think those congregations that have remembered their immigrant roots become in some ways, the best examples of those who are, for example, providing sanctuary. And again, it's the remembering that doesn't engage in a nostalgia that's fixed back there, but it empowers us for the future and for the new people that are around us here and now. I think that's what's become important. Let me conclude by a comment that a German theologian by the name of Johannes Baptist Metz said. Remembering can be seen as a fundamental way of expressing Christian faith. Christian faith becomes a dangerous, subversive memory. Certainly, you could get some glimpses of that in this Eucharistic prayer, which is at the core of a critical consciousness. Yeah, these women persisted, Jesus persisted. What does that call us? What does that empower us to be about today as we too persist in the face of injustice and of who's left out or who needs to be welcomed to into our community, etc. So anyway, I just wanted to say that I think remembering is a central way in which what it means to be Christian comes alive in our day. Not Christian over and against others, but Christian with others, in collaboration with. And I think even though those of us who are confessing Christians might say, yes, that tradition is important to us, and the way some of the things attached to it, whether it's liturgy or all the other kinds of things, at the same time, it is that empowers us for the future and empowers us to be what we need to be about in terms of God's mission in the world today. The mission of God for all people and all creation. Okay, so.
Karen, I did bring the book that I mentioned yesterday. It's called Race in Minnesota, but like I said, I think it could be.
I would love to see it.
Race in Any State, A Good Time for the Truth.
Yeah.
And it's an anthology of people's different writings from their cultural perspective.
So, great.
Anyway, I got it a little wet, so you can look at it, but I got it wet.
Okay, tomorrow we'll be connecting, which isn't quite as biblical a word as remembering, but there's a lot of connecting going on that calls us to lean a little bit into that with some of the ending comments I did today. So, anyway,
thanks,
have a good day of work and recreation and whatever. And feel free to take the